Thank you very much, Darren. Thank you for inviting me. And I want you to know that I took a good bit of teasing from friends and family and colleagues who said they asked you to give a talk on genius. And that was kind of my reaction, too, when Darren first started talking to me about this. You want me to talk about genius? I did write an article on this subject, but it was about the Etruscan genius, which is kind of a technical thing. And before the talk is over, I'll do a little bit with the Etruscans. But mainly, I'm going to go ahead and talk to you about the Roman concept of genius. When the Romans used this word, they did not mean what we mean when we say genius. The basic meaning in Latin can be gleaned from these two entries in standard reference works. The word root here is G-E-N, gen, the same as in generation or progenitor or genital or congenital, various words that relate somehow to giving birth or being born. Now, to give away the conclusion at the very beginning, but we'll also see some nuances and some contradictions. Genius for the Romans referred to a spirit or deity that is born at the same time as the individual and plays a tutelary role throughout his life. The genius is much like a guardian angel, although it is really an integral part of the individual, not separate like an angel. The second entry on the slide here refers to the fact that this spirit has a force or power within it, and that scholars normally interpret this as showing the individual has an attendant reproductive power. The genius is thought of as having to do with desires and the satisfying of desires. Now, notice that the ending of the word is masculine, not neuter. All of you know your Latin, of course, which suggests that it relates to a person, someone who has gender, rather than a thing. And this is in contrast to the word ingenium, which comes from the same word root, but really does mean what we mean when we say genius. It refers to a quality which is inborn and which relates to capacity, talent, ability, genius. The word genius occurs in the earliest Latin literature of the 3rd century BCE, so this would be the earliest usage of the word in Europe and this whole tradition that we're talking about today. But it occurs in the period of the Roman Republic. The concept is generally believed to be a good bit older, for reasons which I'll explain shortly. Genius is a purely Roman concept without a good comparison in, for example, Greek religion or myth. Plautus uses the word frequently in his comedies, often in a very playful and good-natured way. The genius is rather like the characters themselves in the plays of Plautus, who are seeking to have good luck and good time, and the characters often excuse their own tendency to indulgence by saying they are doing it for the benefit of their genius. If someone is going to a fine dinner, he may say he is doing good things for his own genius. So we have Plautus' character saying, genio suo multa bona facere, to do many good things for his own genius. You need to take care of the genius and make offerings and provide good times for this sort of self-patron. Horace, writing 200 years later in the early Roman Empire, reveals more about the genius and his relation to the individual, calling the spirit a natalis comes, a companion from birth, who seems to be in charge of fate and the star under which one is born. And this genius is capable of providing a happy, bright time or causing a gloomy situation. So Horace says, genius natalis comes, qui temperet astrum, naturae deus humanae, mortalis in unum, quodque caput voltu mutabilis albus et ater. So albus is white, bright, shining, ater is dark, gloomy. So the companion from birth who controls the star, human nature's God, mortal for each person, changeable in countenance from bright to gloomy. Another poet contemporary with Horace is Tibullus, And he addresses the genius in regard to birthdays. The genius is supposed to be worshipped or celebrated on someone's birthday. And his elegy, Book 1, Number 7, written for the birthday of his patron Messala, reveals something about the way in which the genius was worshipped. And as I'm talking about this, we can look at three images of geniuses that will help you to visualize this party and how they probably have the little statue of the genius sitting there on the table, and they're addressing the statue. They're talking to it, and they're putting wreaths on it. They're having a good time with it. So Tibullus speaks of dancing and games and the pouring of wine onto the brow of the genius. The celebrants would put perfumed oil on the statuette and would make little garlands to adorn the neck and head. Tibullus goes on to talk about the offerings of incense and honey cake to celebrate the genius. So, huc ades et genium ludis, geniumque cores, concalibret multo tempora funde mero, ilius et nitido stilent unguenta capillo, et capidet colo molia certa gerat. And you have your translation there, which gets a lot of the energy of this. Come here, celebrate the genius with games, the genius with dances. Pour abundant wine upon his brow. Let unguents drip from his gleaming hair. Let him wear soft garlands around head and neck. So you see, this is really something pretty different from the type of genius that Darren is interested in. We might try to get more of this sort of thing in the concept of genius today. In another birthday poem for a young woman, Tibullus refers to the concept of the female genius, who is called not Genia, but rather unexpectedly Juno. Now, she does bear a close relationship to the major Roman goddess Juno, queen of the gods and wife of Jupiter, who is a very powerful figure, especially relevant for marriage and reproduction and regarded as a true queen. Now, the Juno of a girl is a very specific spirit for a particular individual, just like the genius. And this is as opposed to the great goddess Juno. Here Tibullus calls on the birthday spirit and speaks of the incense being offered by a girl who is in love and wants to marry. Natalis Juno sanctos capeturis acervos quos tibidat tenera docta puella manu. Birthday Juno, take the mounds of incense given to you by the tender hand of a girl well educated. And so we see the concept of the pair of the Juno and the genius together, especially in the Roman imperial period, as in this example of statuettes found in excavations in Roman Gaul. They both hold out a patera from which they may pour out a libation, but where they might also receive a libation. The male figure, by his nudity, references his desirability and his ability to beget. The female figure looks like a queen, in fact, rather like the goddess Juno, although she is a personal Juno. And even though we don't see the Juno in genus until the time of the early Roman Empire, we get our earliest references to it. Many people think that this is a kind of an archaic concept, and it goes back to early Rome. So this would be something that's there before we have inscriptions and before we have literature in the 3rd century. And there's really no evidence for that. It's just something we all sort of feel. I mean, I'd like to find some justification for it because it makes sense. This is a very rudimentary concept of fertility, reproduction, that obviously was important in archaic religions. Another piece of evidence occurs in the references in literature to a lectus genialis, a marriage bed, which has to be made ready for the wedding ceremony. The reference may be to little models the bride was asked to make before the ceremony, or to the actual bed, as in the prenuptial iconography of the famous Aldobrandini wedding, where the bride is sitting on the bed receiving instruction from a divine figure, probably her Juno. And the figure at the foot of the bed may well be the genius of the groom, though he has also been identified as Bacchus and as Hymen, the god of marriage. After the marriage, the husband and wife settle into their household and have children. The genius of the husband or father becomes the main patron deity of the household as the genius paterfamilias. Many a painting has survived at Pompeii, showing the religious framework for the typical Roman household of the first century of this common era. Here we have the paterfamilias in absolutely characteristic appearance, dressed in a toga pulled over the head because the genius is acting as a priest, leaving a libation on the altar. He also carries a cornucopia, which speaks to his generative power, fertility, prosperity. He is attended by two lares, spirits of the hearth, who are dressed in charming short tunics and wreaths and are engaged in a playful game of shooting wine from the drinking horn into a bucket. A musician plays, a pig is led up for sacrifice, an altar boy holds up a tray. Down below, we have more of the protectors of the household, the snakes that were allowed to inhabit the hearth area of a house or altar. They are often thought of as ancestors or sent by ancestors, though occasionally the Romans themselves let them play the role of genius. So here they go up to their own altar where they have been offered good things, probably cakes. As I said, these scenes are quite common at Pompeii. Here we have a little altar in the house of the Vettii where the household gods are venerated, and a detail reveals that the lares are pouring wine and the genius is pouring a sacrificial drink onto the ground from his patera, and in his other hand he carries a box full of incense. So the genius is a very personal thing, the personification of the head of the household, and because of the frequent appearance of the serpent at the altar of the house, the genius sometimes appears with a serpent. And some people, even the Romans themselves, sometimes confuse the anthropomorphic genius with the serpent. And here we have a representation of a statuette where the genius holds the cornucopia, pours the libation, and a serpent is crawling around there. Can you see where he is? Right here, wrapped around the arm, and then coming up here above the head. And then in this same slide, we have another way of approaching the genius. This is a dedication of a portrait to Lucius Caecilius Jucundus, a person of elite status in Pompeii, and one of his freed slaves makes a dedication to him. To the genius of our Lucius, Felix the freedman set this up. So here the servant, a member of the household, honors the chief male and establishes that dependence on the genius godhead that goes beyond one's own personal genius. A similar concept now occurs in the Roman Empire, in which the emperor is represented not only as the head of the household, but of the entire city of Rome, of the provinces, of the entire empire. This god relates first of all to the first emperor, Augustus, who died in 14 CE and was not worshipped as a god in his lifetime, but would allow a cult to attach to his genius, as if he's the paterfamilias of the whole Roman Empire. The cult continued and might relate to the cult of the first emperor or to later emperors. Here a coin of the time of Nero is inscribed with Genio Augusti to the genius of Augustus and shows an ideally handsome, mature man who carries out the functions of the paterfamilias of more than the household. The cult of the genius of Augustus, the protective spirit of Rome, becomes widespread under the first emperor himself. His statuettes or altars were set up in neighborhoods across the city of Rome, of which some 265 neighborhoods were recognized. And this is what Ovid refers to, contemporary with Augustus, how there are now these altars all over town where there are lares, household gods, and the genius, the genius. The city of Rome has 1,000 lares, and the genius of the leader who handed them down, and the neighborhoods worship the three godheads. So two lares and one genius are part of each altar setting in the crossroads in the neighborhoods of Rome. Now, the device on coins proved to be immensely popular and a way of spreading messages. So later emperors began to insert numerous other genii on coins. Here is Antoninus Pius with the Genius Senatus, the genius of the Senate, and the later Emperor Severus with the Genius Populi Romani, shown. Other coins and inscriptions reveal numerous other genii of a particular administrative unit, or a god, or a place. We have the Genius Publicus, Genius Senatus, Genius Populi Romani, Genius Exercitus, Latin students, how do you translate that? Genius of the army. Genius Jovis, anybody? Jove, yep, Jupiter. Genius Martis, genius of Mars. Genius Urbis Romae, of the city of Rome, of Britain, of the theater. The Genius Huius Loci Montis, the genius of this place on the mountain. And fountains have a genius. Crossroads have a genius. Any place is inhabited by a spirit. Is the idea that there is this kind of personhood to these various entities. So it goes in the later Roman Empire. The genius remains with us and is popular as an animistic spirit that attends every sort of person, god, or place. Censorinus, writing in the 3rd century CE, gathered together information from various Roman writers. And incidentally, most discussions of the genius start with Censorinus, who's really, you know, very late in the game, but he sums things up for us nicely. Genius is a god under whose protection each person lives from the moment of his birth. Whether it's because he makes sure we get generated, or he is generated with us, or he takes us up and protects us once we are generated, in any case, it is clear he is called Genius from generation, genius from generation. And a little bit of lore is preserved regarding genius, that the proper way to venerate the god is through touching the forehead. And I looked and looked for an image of somebody touching the forehead. I couldn't find a Roman one. I have a little Etruscan one I'll show you in a few moments. But so you can imagine, if you want to pay homage to genius, you must touch your forehead like this. And a kind of a sideline on that is that the forehead is sacred to genius. So in venerating the god, we touch the brow. A kind of sideline to that is that the Juno... for Juno, the woman's eyebrows are sacred. That's all we know about it. There's just one little passage that refers to that. We'd love to know more. Why are the eyebrows sacred? And did this mean, you know, that they would pluck them and drop them on the altar? Well, I'm beginning to go too far on this line of thought. I said I would tell you about the Etruscan genius. And this is a diagram of the heavens, according to... we think the Etruscans, but this is preserved in a very late writer, Marcianus Capella, and he talked about the heavens being divided in 16 parts, and everybody agrees in antiquity and in modern times that the Etruscans had a 16-part heaven. So when Marcianus Capella starts talking about all these different gods living in different parts of the heavens, everybody thinks, well, this must be the Etruscan system, but the names are all in Latin. And so studying Marcianus Capella through the years, I grew curious about the concept of genius. And there are several genii here. Let's see if I can point them out for you. Can you read this from where you're sitting? Okay, there's one there. Here's the genius of the hostess Juno here. So the genius and the Juno are closely associated already for the Etruscans. There's one more. Anybody see it? There's one there. It should be right around in here. There it is. Yeah. Okay. So we have a number of genii in the Etruscan heavens. And so I began to try to figure out who genius was. And I've always worked on Etruscan mirrors. These are my specialty. And so here you see the bronze Etruscan mirror with the reflecting side, which would be polished up, and you could see your image in there, not terribly well, but it would be better than looking into water, which was the other way of finding out what you looked like at this particular period. And these are engraved on the opposite side with scenes from myth. and daily life and religion, and so they're very rich in content. And so I decided that there was a figure on Etruscan mirrors, his name is Maurice, and that he is the equivalent of genius for the Etruscans. And I won't go into my argument at great length, but I'll just show you, here's a Maurice with a spear represented as nude. He has a slightly martial character there, but since Maurice can have different second names in different roles, we don't want to confine him too much. Here we have the Maurice of Tinia. Tinia is the chief god of the Etruscans, and here he is in a story that we know from Greek mythology of the birth of the goddess from his head. It's a birth story, so it's nice to have a genius there. The birth of Athena, you know, from the head of Zeus is here shown. It's the birth of Minerva from the head of Tinia. And so we have the Maris of Tinia, who is present there and who is bearded and is appropriate for Tinia, who also has a beard. And then we have this mirror, which is my favorite of all, and this shows a lot of little baby genii, Maurices, and they all have extra names, so, and we don't know what these names mean. We'd love to know. People have conjectured, but Etruscan is such a difficult language, we don't know. We have Maurice Isminthians, and Maurice Husernana, and Maurice Halna, and a bevy of deities are doing something with those babies. I think they're being born, and they're going to be sent to the appropriate person to accompany that person throughout life. Well, the transition is not smooth to my last slide, but I did find an image of an Etruscan touching his forehead. It does come from a tomb, and it has to do with the dead rather than with birth, but I'll leave you with this image of someone touching the forehead. Salute all of the geniuses here today.